Welcome to the Press On Podcast. In this episode, we'll hear from John Launchbury on origins of Psalm 23.
Psalm 23 is probably the best known of all the Psalms. It is simple and yet profound and beautiful, and it applies to so many circumstances. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. It's a beautiful psalm. People know it. People quote it. But why did David write it? What were the circumstances that led him to these particular words? I find that a fascinating question. We can't know the answer for certain, but it turns out that every stanza of the psalm corresponds very closely with what happened as David had to flee from Jerusalem in the face of Absalom's rebellion. You may well be familiar with the account as recorded in 2 Samuel 15 through 17, but I'd like to tell the story nonetheless. The story begins after David had been king for many years in Jerusalem. The early days of battle conquests had quietened down to the tedious day-to-day of politics. I think he was not well suited to that world. He'd become something of a recluse and may even have started losing his touch. People across many of the tribes of Israel began to think of him as not such a good king, perhaps because he was no longer engaged with them in the way that he used to be. In contrast, Absalom, his son, was a rising star. Absalom had recently been allowed to return to the land after his banishment for a revenge killing of his brother. And now he's actively ingratiating himself with the whole population. When people would come to get a judgment from King David, Absalom would pull them aside. "My father, the king, doesn't have time for you," he would imply. Tell me what you want, and I'll sort it out." With these tactics, Absalom's influence and popularity grows and grows, and after a while, he becomes the most popular leader in the whole nation. He decides it's time to get rid of the old man. Now is the time to act. Now is the time to seize power. He gets many of the tribes to support him in his quest, gathering the strength of Israel together. He assembles an army and begins to march on Jerusalem to depose his father, to kill David. When David hears the news that a large army is on the march in support of Absalom, he knows exactly what that means. He realizes he has to get out of the capital as soon as possible. If he stays in Jerusalem, the armies will lay siege to the city and likely destroy it. David will be overthrown and thousands of innocent people will be killed in the process. And suddenly the battle hardened leader within him is awakened. He gathers what forces he has, perhaps a few thousand soldiers, and with his wives and children, they all begin immediately fleeing from the city. It's very likely that they exit through Jerusalem's east gate because they head down the Kidron Valley, they cross the brook, and work their way up the Mount of Olives. 1,000 years later, his descendant Jesus will make a similar journey, also when facing a gathering enemy force. Jesus will leave the upper room of the Last Supper, and he also will go out of the east gate down to the Kidron Brook. All the teachings recorded in John 14 through 17 will occur on this journey, including the beautiful prayer for unity that all his disciples might be united with him and his Father, just as the two of them are united with each other. And then Jesus also will cross the brook, and he will head up the Mount of Olives to the orchard of Gethsemane, where he will devote himself to his Father in his soul-searching prayer of submission. But now, 1,000 years earlier, David and his household walk that path. As they leave the city, David notes some foreign soldiers accompanying him. He offers to release them from service, but they decline. They're committed to David because they honor and trust him. "We will be with you," they say, whether it means life or death. I think David is moved by this. His own son is rebelling, and yet these men, who are not even from Israel, are faithful to him, willing to die for him. As he crosses the Kidron Valley, he meets the priests from the tabernacle. They have brought the Ark of the Covenant with them as a mark of solidarity with David. But in a remarkable act of faith, David instructs the priests to take the Ark back to Jerusalem, saying, "Take the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back and let me see it and his dwelling place again. But if he says, 'I am not pleased with you,' then I am ready. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him." That's 2 Samuel 15. And with that, David carries on walking up to the top of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he goes. As he climbed, he may well have turned around and looked back. If so, he would have seen Jerusalem laid out in front of him. He himself had captured this city and made it his capital, and now he was being forced to abandon it. But it gets even worse. David hears a report that Bathsheba's grandfather, Ahithophel, had sided with Absalom and is advising him on how to beat David. This is too much. Such a close friend and brother. We get a glimpse of David's feelings in Psalm 55. "My heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death assail me. Fear and trembling have beset me. Horror has overwhelmed me. I said, 'Oh, that I had the wings of a dove. I would fly away and be at rest. I would flee far away and stay in the desert. I would hurry to my place of shelter, far from the tempest and storm. If an enemy were insulting me, I could endure it. If a foe were raising himself against me, I could hide from him. But it is you, a man like myself, my companion, my close friend with whom I once enjoyed sweet fellowship as we walked with the throng at the house of God." Again, 1,000 years later, Jesus will experience similar distress at the betrayal by the disciple with whom he too had enjoyed sweet fellowship in the house of God. For David, the betrayal was particularly worrying because the advice of Ahithophel was always so insightful. It was like asking advice from God. So what to do about it? He prays for God to intervene. And on reaching the hilltop, he meets the answer to his prayer, his friend Hushai. Hushai, himself an accomplished warrior, fully intends never to leave David's side. But David's strategic mind immediately concocts a plan. He asks Hushai to go back to Jerusalem where he can help by frustrating Ahithophel's advice. Hushai agrees. He re-enters Jerusalem intending to see what mischief he can cause, just as Absalom himself reaches the city. David is now heading east. He and the crowd with him are continuing onward into the dry Judean hills. They'll be spending the rest of the day walking through these desert lands, heading for the Jordan Valley. That will be a good place to rest. The Jordan Valley is lush. The river winds lazily through the valley floor before feeding into the Great Salt Sea, what we today call the Dead Sea. Perhaps you remember when Lot and Abraham were going to part ways. Lot looked around and he saw the Jordan Valley. What wonderful farmland it was. The agricultural opportunities there were like the farm garden that God planted in Eden. It was a beautiful place for growing crops. It was an easy choice for him to make. and it's to this same Jordan Valley that David is heading. He's planning for them all to spend the night there, to recuperate. Meanwhile, back in Jerusalem, Ahithophel is advising Absalom, "Send troops to David immediately," he advises. "Perform a surgical strike. Get David. Let everybody else live. Once David is gone," Ahithophel assures him, "Absalom will have all Israel supporting him." Ahithophel's advice is compelling, and Absalom thinks seriously about it. But just then, Hushai walks in. Absalom sees him and naturally asks for his advice also. Hushai points out that, as Absalom knows, his father, King David, is a great warrior. He's not going to be sleeping with all his people. Instead, he'll be hiding in a cave somewhere. David will have set a trap, Hushai claims. So if Absalom sends a strike team, he will suffer defeat that will damage morale when people hear about it. And the people may then even turn back to supporting David. Instead, Hushai advises, Absalom should amass an even greater army than he currently has and punish everybody who's standing with David. Get rid of them all. Absalom thinks about this and decides he's going to follow Hushai's advice. That was a critical moment. If Absalom had followed Ahithophel's advice, then David would probably have been caught and killed. Ahithophel knows this, and he also knows that Absalom is now following bad advice. But there's nothing to be done. He can see the writing on the wall. He goes back to his home and hangs himself. But that's another story. It's very late in the day now, and David's group comes down into the Jordan Valley. They've reached the river. They're able to refresh themselves after the long, long day in the dry hills. They lie down in the green pastures. They bathe in the quiet waters. But they don't get to rest for very long. Hushai has been able to send messengers to David to report. It's very cloak and dagger stuff for the messengers to get through Absalom's security perimeter. But they did, and now they come to David. Hushai's message is that David and his people have to cross the Jordan right now. And so through that night, that's what they do, wading through the deep water until they're all on the other side. And indeed, by daybreak, they are all across the Jordan. But now, where to go? What do we do? They're on the far side of the Jordan at something, but it can't really be defended. So despite the hard march the day before, they immediately start working their way north along the east bank of the Jordan River. It's not easy with so many people, David's wives and children and his army, maybe up to about 5,000 people or so. Another day's march, probably having to stop for the night on the way. Psalm 3 gives us insight into David's frame of mind on this journey. The ancient header of the psalm declares, "A psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son." Listen to his thoughts. "O Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, 'God will not deliver him.' But you are a shield around me, O Lord. You bestow glory on me and lift up my head. To the Lord I cry aloud, and he answers me from his holy hill. I lie down and sleep. I wake again because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear the tens of thousands drawn up against me on every side. Arise, O Lord, deliver me, O my God." Do you see how relevant this psalm is for these circumstances? He's admitting that he can't control whether he will get up in the morning, because there are thousands of people against him, and they may come and attack him at any moment. But because of his trust in the Lord, he will lie down, and he will sleep. Halfway between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee, they come to the confluence of the Jordan and the River Jabbok. They decide to leave the Jordan, they will turn east, and wend their way through the Jabbok Valley, aiming for the highlands beyond. However, for a crowd of people fleeing a pursuing army, the Jabbok could be a scary place. The wide open valley of the mouth soon narrows as it enters into the mountains. Over time, the river had formed deep canyons through the hills, and as David and his companions traversed the deepest of these, I imagine them looking up and seeing the bright sky above while all around is deep shadow. This is dangerous. If Absalom has placed armies ahead of them and behind, they'll have no chance for escape. They'll all be slaughtered. The valley of the shadow of death. But David understands that this is the best path to safety, and so they risk the canyons of the Jabbok until eventually they emerge at the higher ground on the other side. They arrive at the settlement of Mahanaim. Mahanaim was named by Jacob some 800 years previously. He and his family stopped here for the night when they were traveling south to reconcile with Esau. Jacob had perceived it as a place where God was camped too, which is why he named it Mahanaim. It means two camps, Jacob's camp and the camp of the angels of God. And it was here that he wrestled with one of the angels through the night. And now, as David and his people arrive at Mahanaim, they're met by a group of wealthy older men led by Barzillai. They welcome the whole company with open arms and provide all kinds of food and comfort for everybody. Scripture is effusive in its description. When David came to Mahanaim, Barzillai and his friends brought bedding and bowls and articles of pottery. They also brought wheat and barley, flour and roasted grain, beans and lentils, honey and curds, sheep, and cheese from cow's milk for David and his people to eat. For they said, "The people have become exhausted and hungry and thirsty in the wilderness." I think David is overwhelmed by their kindness and generosity. And perhaps it's at this moment he realizes that Absalom has missed his chance. David is going to be able to prevail. He will be able to go back to Jerusalem. Now that we've heard the story again, listen once more to Psalm 23. "The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever." In the absence of an ancient descriptive header, we don't know for sure if this is when David composed it. But there's such remarkable correspondence between the psalm and his experience while fleeing from Absalom that I suspect it may even have been that night. We can imagine the crowds of people gathered around campfires. Maybe David borrows a lyre and he starts to play and sing under the stars. He sings of how God led them to lie down in those lush pastures when they arrived at the Jordan, and how God was leading him beside still waters as they trekked up the river valley. And then he sings of the Jabbok Canyons, where they experienced the terrors of the valley of the shadow of death, where they prayed their trust in God. And then he sings of this night in Mahanaim, where God had prepared a table before them, even though their enemies were at hand. "My cup overflows," sings David, overwhelmed with gratitude. And now the tide has turned and the battle will be won. So David sings that he will once again return to the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. Sadly, the tune is lost to us, but we still have his words. and they continue to sing into many, many hearts down through the ages. It's remarkable how powerful these lyrics are. Even though his journey may have been the inspiration for the psalm, David's words are not constrained by that context, because he's expressing a living truth from the depth of his being. He knew his very existence depended on God, that he didn't have sufficient power to save himself from the forces of Absalom. Psalm 23 describes his experience of placing himself in the hands of the Lord, submitting to the will of God, however it would unfold. For me personally, Psalm 23 became very poignant after I recently faced death. I had a medical emergency with a low chance of survival. And in that moment, knowing that this may be the end of my life, I found myself at peace. Whatever was going to happen, I knew that God held me in his arms of love, and I didn't need to fear anything. And so since then, Psalm 23 has become especially meaningful to me. I sometimes recite it in the evenings as a prayer at the end of the day. And on some occasions, I rephrase it into the past tense, when I walked through the valley of the shadow of death. I feared no evil, for you were with me, your rod and your staff, they comforted me. In Hebrew, the rod is a scepter. It signifies authority. Mostly, it's just a symbol of rulership, but sometimes it was used to physically strike people to enforce authority. In contrast, the staff is the walking stick, the one that you lean on. It's for support. So the reference to God's rod and staff means God's rulership and support. Your rulership, David says, and your support, they comfort me through the valley of the shadow of death. And the way that David constructs this prayer psalm is quite illuminating. He starts out thinking about God. The Lord is my shepherd. He's not talking to God here, but he's reflecting on how God shows up in life. And he continues this way for the first few verses. But then at the pinnacle of the psalm, David transitions to speaking directly to God. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. David is showing that thinking about God can naturally lead to talking to God. And so he continues on as he offers thanks to God. And then after this central prayer, the psalm shifts back to reflecting about God again. Surely I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever, David sings, once again describing God in the third person. I think this is a good model for our prayers, to have these two modes, switching back and forth between thinking about God and talking to God. And this psalm itself, I suggest, is worth praying frequently. There will come a day when each one of us faces our own valley of the shadow of death. And as you pray the psalm, pause to contemplate that moment. Am I ready for the moment of deep darkness? And when that time comes, will the rulership and support of God be a comfort to me?
Thanks for joining us on the Press On podcast. You've been listening to John Launchbury. For more, you can visit pressonjournal.org.